Thank you, Rabbi Short. I do apologize in advance. Originally agreed to this date. I didn't realize I'd have a cold today. So I apologize if it's a little difficult to hear, but I'll do my best. Parshas Noach, which we'll be reading this week, has a lot of relevance to the question of the general death penalty debate, which I'd like to reflect upon a little bit today. It's a topic of, by its very nature, much controversy. It's a topic probably should be one of much controversy. It's a topic of which reasonable people can intensely disagree and do disagree because there's much to be said on both sides, and particularly because I'd like to look at it from the perspective of American society, of what our attitude may be towards this question in America. It's particularly relevant to Parshas Noach, both because Parshas Noach is a time when we learn about broader society, about the obligations of Bnei Noach, of the mitzvot that apply to all of humanity, and not specifically to the Jewish people, and also particularly in the context of the death penalty for, let's say, murder, its most prominent example. There is a direct reference in this week's parsha where we're told that shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishofech, one who kills someone else. The whole discussion of what is the connotation of adam ba'adam, it's a separate discussion, but the theme of his blood should be spilled in retribution or in punishment for that, however you want to understand that, is one that very much is relevant to Parshas Noach. So I'd like to reflect a little bit about this question and the emphasis on reflection rather than on any absolute statements. I think this is a topic where we can be misdirected in many ways. I think if you ask the average person, what do they feel the Torah's perspective is towards the death penalty? So they're aware of, say, two sources that have to be balanced. They're aware of the fact that the Mishnah in Makos, which is here on the Mar Makomos, tells us that apparently happened very rarely, that a Bezdin that would kill once in 7 years, once in 70 years, on the one hand is called a Bezdin Chavlonis, Bezdin that is damaging, that is wounding, negative descriptions. On the other hand, we know clearly the Torah prescribes the death penalty in many, many cases. So on the one hand, we have the Torah telling us throughout, not only this week's parasha, but certainly in many other contexts, of a punishment of death. On the other hand, here, this attitude, which, as you see, is not the only attitude in Chazal, but it's the more famous attitude in Chazal, that it should be exceedingly rare. And if you look at Rashi and Makos, it's not just that it happens to be rare, but it's clear that Sanhedrin would make an effort to make sure it would be more than rare. It would be really less than once in a yovel. And when we're really, really rare, we use once in a yovel as an expression for rarity, and this is less often than once in a yovel. So the intuitive balance that we have is, okay, maybe it's something that's on the books, but is meant to be practiced very rarely, practiced almost never, perhaps. And that attitude may be correct. I'm not here today to say whether it's correct or incorrect, but it's oversimplification. There's a lot more to the discussion, a lot more that has to be stated in understanding it, particularly because part of what we have to be clear about, at least in terms of discussing it, is that there are a number of different contexts in which the death penalty could be relevant. And as we'll discuss, there are at least three different distinct settings in which one could talk about the death penalty. And to assume that what the Mishnah says about Sanhedrin, that whether or not the Sanhedrin would execute, let's say, a Machal Shabbos, or this context sounds more like a murderer, but all the different types of Chiyuvei Misa that we find in the Torah, very often for more ritually based offenses, to assume that the standard that's applied there is the same standard we would say should be applied in the United States is not necessarily an obvious jump. There is a lot in between them. So I'd like to look at some of the different contexts in which we find a concept of a death penalty. I think there are at least three. And to try to figure out what model we can use to try to understand a little bit about how to look at this debate. And again, I think it's an issue where we can, in the end of the day, end up having different perspectives, but just to look at a little bit at what might influence the discussion. So first of all, just within the context of the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin really is addressed to Jewish society. This is our judicial branch, and we're not so clear yet that this should be the model for the whole world. But in the context of the Sanhedrin, so certainly we do find the death penalty, at least on the books, in a large number of cases. And it's interesting that one could perhaps suggest there's a very technical debate, which maybe is philosophically relevant, even though it seems very technical. It's clear that there is a mitzvah for Beis Din to execute the guilty. That seems to be the direction of the Torah. But what's not clear is how many mitzvos is it? And that's some of the sources here represent that machlokas a little bit. Sounds like a very technical machlokas. You might say, well, what difference does it make? We'll count it as one mitzvah, we'll count it as four, we'll count it as however many mitzvahs we count it. It's a question in general, what difference does it make how you count mitzvahs? That itself is a whole discussion. But we know the Rishonim spent time figuring out how to classify and how to categorize the mitzvos. So in this context, so we find at least three views as to how these mitzvahs should be counted. According to the Ramban, this is all one mitzvah. There is one directive, which is repeated a number of times in the Torah, but it counts as one mitzvah, of ubiyar taharah mikirbecha, that you have to eliminate the evil from your midst, and all of the misas bezdin, every instance where a Sanhedrin is directed to execute somebody, is subsumed under that one heading. According to the Rambam, which is listed here, he counts it as four mitzvos. Four mitzvos corresponding to the four different misos bezdin that we have. Skila, Sreifa, Hereg, and Chenek. Without getting into the details of what each one involves, we know that there are four models of execution in the Torah, four different types, and therefore the Rambam counts four mitzvos. The third opinion is that of the Bahag. It's, the Rambam very much takes issue with. It's quoted in the Shrashim and the Sefer HaMitzvos, that the Bahag counts more than one and more than four. He counts each one separately. 30-something times the Torah says that this person is Chayiv Misa, so the Bahag says each one is its own obligation. The Rambam thinks that that doesn't make sense, and the Ramban defends it, even though he is on the other side of the equation. So essentially we have three views. Either it's one big mitzvah, or it's four, or it's many, many, many mitzvos, one for each time the Torah says this Avera is punished with death. So is there some kind of philosophical basis for this debate? So one could possibly suggest that there is an issue here that they're arguing about as to what really is the focus of maybe punishment in general, and punishment in this context in Mises Bezdin. And to give a more mundane example, so let's say, so I'm a teacher in school, so let's say in theory, somebody's talking in class, and I would throw them out of class. I don't think I've ever actually done that, but let's say in theory, I would do that. So if I threw somebody out of the class, why would I do that? So there are at least three categories of reasons as to why I would do that. One reason is, I would throw him out of class because I can't teach the class if he's talking. And if I'm trying to communicate and he's making noise and he's distracting everybody, so then the class is going to suffer because this is going on. So for the good of the class, I have to say, go away. I have to remove this element from the class so that I can communicate with the class properly. That would be one reason. So we'll call that the good of the class, the good of society. Society needs this element removed. A second reason why I might do it, it's not necessarily because of the class. The class is okay. I'm more interesting than he is. They'll listen to me. They're not going to listen to him. I can talk over him. But I have to worry about him, that if he thinks that he can get away with talking, and he's going to do it every day, and he can break whatever rule he wants, and nothing ever happens to him, so then he's going to live life like that, and he's going to end up becoming a terrible criminal, and who knows what's going to happen down the line. So for his own good, for the sake of the offender, I have to straighten him out. Part of my responsibility as a teacher also, so I have to tell him I'm punishing you now so that you are going to learn and you're going to grow up a law-abiding citizen. The third approach is maybe I'm not worried about teaching, I'm lighter than him, and I'm not worried about him either. I'm a substitute teacher, I don't have to worry about his development. I'm worried about the law. that if I have a sign on the wall that says no talking in class, and this guy's talking and nothing happens, he can do it with impunity, so then the law doesn't mean anything. So then it becomes meaningless. So in order to make sure that the law has bite to it, I have to enforce it, there has to be a consequence to violating the law. So one could suggest that these three different elements are at issue here, that the Ramban sees the main focus as the protection of society. Society has to be saved from the evil element in it that has to be removed, and everything is subsumed under that goal. While the Rambam, perhaps, Rambam has a distinction, a little hard to understand on the surface, to say, well, we'll distinguish between Skila, Sreifa, Herig, and Chenek. What does that really have to do with anything? So the different types of methodologies that are used, why should that categorize things? Why should I group all the skilas together? And why should I separate the skilas and sreifas? Doesn't really, on the surface, make itself so clear. What's the distinction between the four? The distinction is, it's understood that each one is a different level of severity. Each one affects a different level of atonement. One misa is considered to be more severe than the other. So the notion is that someone who needs to be atoned, someone who needs to have a restoration made to his soul because of what he's done wrong, so there's different it's different levels of atonement, level A, B, C, and D. And therefore the Torah is apparently saying there's a mitzvah to give level A atonement, level B, level C, level D. Each one is its own separate endeavor. So by dividing things along those lines, as the Rambam is choosing to do, the Rambam is apparently saying that the focus is the good of the sinner. How much atonement does the sinner need? Now, from a more secular, temporal point of view, it's hard to see execution as for your own good. You're not going to be able to progress from this point. Maybe other types of punishment, imprisonment, others that may have hope for rehabilitation, maybe you could see that as for your own good. Execution wouldn't seem to be that way. But from a religious perspective, so we believe that there is a world beyond this one and that there is a stage to go after this. So even execution could, in theory, be a punishment that would be good for the sinner on that level. And perhaps that's the Rambam's focus. While the Bahag, by focusing on each crime individually, seems that what the Bahag is saying is that there's a mitzvah, whatever mitzvah we're talking about, a mitzvah to not commit this transgression. And then there's another mitzvah on society to uphold that transgression, to say that this transgression is supported by society with punishment. And that each one is individual, it's not some larger value, but that in each case, this din has to be protected with the punishment of society. So what emerges is we essentially have at least three focuses, and there are a few others that could be suggested as well, which might be categorized together with these, but at least three elements to Mises Beis Din: the element of protecting society, the element of for the good of the sinner, for the good of the criminal, and the upholding of the basic concept of the law. And all of those exist, and presumably all of these Rishonim agree with the others that these all exist. The question is, what's our focus? The question is, what are we directed towards? And once we look at one as the dominant element, let's say, V'yarta Rav Mikrabecha, so it could be that some other issues might be understood in that context. Just to quickly mention a few. For example, the Mishnah tells us in Sanhedrin that when somebody was executed, so he would be fed a drink that would intoxicate him, that would dull his senses so he wouldn't perceive what's going on. And that this is true for all of the Dalai Mises Beis Din. And it's interesting. So here we go to all this trouble to have different gradations of severity, and yet at the last minute we basically insulate them from it. So it's interesting to focus on the perspective that maybe these various severities are part of making an announcement to society. Moshe Sternbuch has an essay about this in one of his Svarim. And maybe that's about making a statement to society, but at the same time we still have Rachmanis on the individual at that moment. Maybe also directs our attention towards, let's say, the focus being Ubiyarta Rami Kubacha, as that being the key element. It's also a part of the question, if we say it's society's responsibility to clean itself up, so does that extend to the defendant also? So once he is judged to be chayiv misa, so is he also a part of society that's chayiv in that? That's the discussion some of the achronim had. The kajikal of a rav has the truth in which he says this obligation is on all society, including the defendant. He's also a part of this mitzvah, but not... which is not to say, he says, that he has the option of killing himself, that it has to come through a punishment that has to be imposed upon him, but he has to cooperate. The question some of the posts can talk about, if a religious person finds himself in this situation, so is he allowed to run away? Munkach Rebbe had a tshuva about this, where he said that he has an obligation not to run away, but he says if he knows that he was falsely convicted, he's not sure. But he knows he was guilty, then he has an obligation not to run away. If he knows he was falsely convicted, he wasn't sure. So that's part of the question of who's doing this. Is this society's obligation, of which the defendant is part of society? A lot of implications of trying to understand where exactly this mitzvah is going. Okay. I want to get to that. That's a whole separate arena, so I'm going to get to that in a few minutes. Another element that's also relevant is the question that's also in this week's parasha. There's a Ramban in the parasha's Noach that argues the Rambam and Maror Nebuchim. The Ramban is listed here, I think, about whether Biarta Rami Kavecha can apply to an animal. That we know there are times when the Torah says that an animal is to be put to death for things that the animal does. So is that understood as a function of Biarta Rami Kavecha? Or do we say that animals don't have souls, they don't have free will? It's not a question of punishment, this is really a punishment for the owner. So that was a debate between the Ramban and the Rambam and Maror Nebuchim, which also fits into this larger discussion of what exactly is the focus of the Sanhedrin. There's much more to discuss about this, but just on that level, so one could pose a general question as to what exactly is the Sanhedrin trying to accomplish, and to recognize that in the broader rubric of Mises Besdin, so there are various functions that are there, both this element of protecting society together with this element of achieving a kapara for the sinner, together also with this element of making sure that the law is meaningful, and all of this has impacts in various areas of how the Sanhedrin would operate. Now, within that context, so we do find, as we see from at least the more famous opinion in the Gemara and Makkos, that it was apparently exceedingly rare. Whether you accept that view or not, clearly the details that we're familiar with about how Mises Besdin is carried out, by definition, is going to make it very, very rare. That we know that in order for there to be a Mises Besdin, so first of all, we need Edim. So you need two kosher witnesses who are not related to each other, who are not related to the criminal, who saw it themselves, and who are not disqualified for whatever reason. And they have to give the defendant hasra. Hasra is exceedingly difficult. So first of all, they have to tell him what he's doing. There's a whole debate in the Rishonim how specific they have to get, but they have to tell the individual what he's doing and what he's up for. And they have to do it before he commits the crime. So they have to be anticipatory witnesses. They have to realize what's going to happen, and they have to warn him beforehand. And here's one of the harder elements. So he has to accept it. He has to be matir atzmo lemisa. He has to accept the hasra. So it's hard to, you know, nowadays you need a fancy lawyer to get yourself off. In the time of the Sanhedrin, you need a fancy lawyer to get yourself convicted. It's not so easy. So you have to have extensive legal advice to know how to get convicted. So you have to say, I accept this hasra. Essentially, part of the discussion about whether the death penalty is appropriate or not in history, there was an Italian philosopher in the 1700s. His name was Cesare of Beccaria, who wrote extensively against the death penalty. He wrote essays that were very influential on some of the founding fathers of the United States, like John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. This is a large part of the early debate in America about the death penalty. The debate in America predates the nation. In the 1600s already, they were killing witches in Boston, and society has been fighting about this for 400 years in America. It's not a simple issue. So this philosopher was very influential on some of the early founding fathers, and one of the points that one of his major arguments was that society doesn't have the right kill anybody. That there's nothing in government that gives them the right to kill anybody. The only reason the government ever has a right to do anything is because people get together and they aggregate all their rights and they say, we give over to a central control certain rights, and nobody would ever give over to the government the right to kill them. So therefore, by definition, society never has the right to kill anybody. And this predates him. Also, Locke and Hobbes talked about this. And others have dismissed this. Later, Kant wrote that it's not what's going on. That the idea is that you agree to be a part of society and to follow the laws of society. And the punishment then comes through the authority of society. It's not that you give society the elements of the punishment to act upon you. It's not that you give them the authority to kill you. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to do any punishment. You're not going to give them the right to imprison you either. You're not going to give them any specific punishment, right? It's that you agree to the laws of society, and society then has a certain authority to it. So somebody wrote an essay once, Rabbi Chaim Reinitz, where he suggested that that was also what's going on here when we talk about the Yatir Atzmo L'Misa, that that's what's going on, that you acknowledge the authority of the Sanhedrin, and then the Sanhedrin works on its divine authority to do what it does. So either this is a necessity of Yatir Atzmo L'Misa, he's got to accept it, and then he has to perform this crime within Toch Kedei Dibur. This is one of the hardest requirements. Toch Kedei Dibur, at most, is 9 seconds. It's very possible that it's 3 seconds. So he has to commit the crime within a small number of seconds. And if more than that time elapses, so then the Hasra expires. And it's no good. So why that is? So Rashi and Ksubas, it sounds like the issue is that he forgot. It's very hard to believe. Right? So you know, you're going to come to court and you say, didn't you know you're not allowed to kill somebody? Or somebody just told you that you're not allowed to kill people. Two people came up to you and said you're not allowed to kill. You said you knew. You're going to tell me you didn't know? Well, that was 30 seconds ago. You think I remember? Or you think I'm able to hold on so long? So that's a whole discussion. Ksosa Choshen had a very hard time with this. What exactly is going on here? And Salvechik very famously explained that in his understanding, the idea of Hasra, which is one opinion the Gemara suggests, Hasra is there to establish that an aver is being done b'mezid, it's being done intentionally. So what does intentionally mean? You might think intentionally means, okay, I know it's wrong, I'm doing it with awareness, that's intent. So Soloveitchik suggested that intent doesn't just mean that. It means that in order for Sanhedrin to execute, so it requires much more than awareness, it requires much more than somebody were to say to you, don't you know you're not allowed to do this? Well, yeah, now that I think about it, I know I'm not allowed to do it. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about you have to commit the transgression at the moment you're thinking about how wrong it is. You are rebelling right now against the Torah so much that you are focused on its prohibition and you're committing it anyway. I think the expression was, you have to know at heichan hu poreik ol, to what extent is he throwing off all accountability? Is he saying that even as it's in my active consciousness, they told me about this 2 seconds ago and I'm still doing it while I'm thinking about it, then you have a real level of rebellion, which as some later writers suggest, that's an incorrigibility that really requires the absolute punishment. And absent of that, maybe you don't have that standard. So all of that you need to get to trial. And once you have that, then you get to the Sanhedrin, and then it gets harder. Then, again, you need a fancy lawyer to get convicted, because it's not so easy to get convicted in the Sanhedrin. And here the structure of trial is different than the model in American society. So in American society, the government has essentially decided that this individual is guilty. That's why they brought him to trial. And the government has a representative in the form of a prosecutor making this case. And the defendant has an advocate. Either he pays him or the government supplies it. And they have an adversarial situation between his advocate, the defense attorney, and the prosecutor. And the judge and the jury are presumably neutral. The jury will decide on guilt or innocence and the punishment, and the judge will oversee the proceedings. And the judge and the jury are neutral. The government is advocating for the prosecution, and the defendant is advocating for the defense. And the structure of the Sanhedrin, so we have it differently. Society, essentially, is advocating the crime. The witnesses represent society. The witnesses come and they say, this is what we saw happen. They're advocating the position of guilt, and the Torah says they actually have to carry it out also. And the Sanhedrin is actually playing really a triple role. They are the jury, also they're the judges, and they're the jury. They're going to decide whether he's guilty or not. And they're the defense attorneys. They also have to have, among their number, people who will advocate for innocence. And that's why we have this startling halacha. A couple of startling halachas. One halacha that we have is that if, let's Sanhedrin, if a guy would come in front of Sanhedrin and kill somebody and they'd see it, so then they wouldn't be qualified to issue a ruling on him. We have a halacha of Einaid Naisadayin, and somebody who witnesses can't be a judge. And the way it's understood by some of the Rishonim is the issue is that they're not going to be able to advocate for his innocence. They need to advocate for his innocence, and they can't do it if they're going to be hampered because they saw it happen. It's going to get in the way. So you see how crucial the role of the defense attorney is as part of the Sanhedrin. And also the striking halacha, which which is well known, that Sanhedrin, Shirel, Kul, Lachov, if they all are unanimous and they all decide that he's guilty, so then he's not going to get convicted, which is, again, very different from American law, where it's generally the case that you require a unanimous jury in order to convict somebody. So here, unanimity is considered to be a problem. So on one level, it's considered to be a problem, as it's often explained, because how could things be so clear-cut? How could it be that nobody sees anything any differently? That's got to be proof that something is not so obvious. But also, as explained on a different level, that it's an indication that there's nobody acting on his defense. There's nobody in the Sanhedrin arguing for his innocence, so then he's lacking the proper defense on that level. That becomes a problem. So all of this is a very, very large obstacle towards ever actually executing anybody within the Sanhedrin context. So you can understand where this attitude would come from, that such a thing would be exceedingly rare.
So somebody who, got convicted, what happens to
them? Oh, so great segue. So that's exactly what I wanted to get up to now. So the question is, well, on the one hand, we may we may appreciate all of that. We appreciate all the checks and balances that are in place, both from a perspective of Rachmanis and a perspective of protecting from error, which is obviously one of the major concerns, the major elements. So to have all these safeguards and roadblocks in place is, on the one hand, comforting. On the other hand, it's not so comforting. So what happens to society? So you can have a society where people know that, again, they can save a lot on defense fees because it's more expensive to get yourself convicted. So it's very easy to evade all these rules. Just wait 10 seconds instead of 9 seconds before, after the warning. So you're going to have a society that's essentially open to all types of crime because Sanhedrin can't do anything. So that's not exactly the case. So here's where I said there are three contexts. So context number two is outside of that absolute setting of the Sanhedrin. There's another setting the Sanhedrin function in. Setting one is really the Sanhedrin acting as the guardian of ritual law, as the guardian of the Torah. But there's also a different role which Sanhedrin plays as the guardian of society, and in this case, they share it together with the king. There is a notion of Mishpat HaMelech, that the king, acting now as the government, acting as the protector of society, has the right to impose punishment really on his own discretion. And it seems that Sanhedrin also had this function as well. The Gemara has the expression, Shamati Shebez Din Makin Va'onshin Shalom Min Hadin, that we've heard, it's like a rumor in the street, that the Sanhedrin sometimes acts outside of the parameters of what's dictated in its normal protocol. And it's understood that there are circumstances where Sanhedrin is going to decide that society is threatened and we need to act in a different capacity. There's a little bit of a debate among the Rishonim, if you look on the side of the tour, in the beginning of Choshen Mishpat, where this is discussed, a little bit of debate whether this was something that coexisted with the Mises Beis Din function of Sanhedrin. Right? That itself was limited. In addition to all the other limitations, so Sanhedrin would only be done dinei nefashos when it was next to the Beis HaMikdash, and they stopped doing this even before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. It was only in their office in the Lishkas HaGazis by the Beis HaMikdash during the time of the Beis HaMikdash, before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and not even up until then. So there was a limitation historically as to when Sanhedrin was involved in this. So there is debate among the Rishonim, this idea that the Sanhedrin can act outside of their parameters and also choose to execute somebody when it's necessary for society. So was that only during that time period, or is that even later? So that's a little bit of a debate among the Rishonim, but it seems to be understood that there is this essentially second category that the Sanhedrin did take upon itself.
It's called Gilead in localities. How do you explain that? You're talking always in the context of Sanhedrin.
Right, so then the rules...
The idea of the Farshas in localities also.
Right, so that's also, how does that play out in the context of history is also a little bit of a discussion that takes us a little bit more detail than we're going to get into now, but it's an important point. So that's a debate to what extent this extra legal authority would extend to. We're probably familiar with the passage in the Gemara about the kippah, not the modern kippah we're familiar with, but the kippah, the jail cell that they had, where essentially murderers, people who had evaded the protocol, but they were known to be a threat to society, how they were locked up and they were fed concoction that would lead to their deaths. And some of the Rishonim explained that it specifically had to be an indirect causation of death, because that final step of executing outside of the rules of the Sanhedrin maybe was too far to go. But there is certainly this concept of Sanhedrin acting in a little bit of a different capacity, as a role shared with the government in the sense of the Mishpat HaMelech, which the Ran has a lengthy drush about, this often quoted, drush Yud Aleph. That's a whole other separate category. So this category was a discussion. For a long time, it didn't seem like this category was really relevant, but in 1948, so this issue came up again. So now when you have a Jewish government in place again, so there was a major discussion. So discussion both among the secular authorities and among the halachic authorities and among everywhere in between. So if there's a Jewish government, so does this Mishpat HaMelech concept come up again? Can this new modern Jewish government take upon itself the authority to execute criminals, to say, okay, this is part of what we do to protect society? So this was a debate mostly, I believe, in the early 50s. This issue was being debated in the Knesset, and it went to the chief rabbinate and to a number of other figures who were associated with the chief rabbinate. And as I understand it, the dominant rabbinic opinion at that time of those who were consulted is that this is not appropriate, that we can't necessarily give a classification of malchus to the modern society, and that the notion of the malchus executing somebody is under the assumption that that's necessary to protect society. But perhaps if you have a setting where you have a life imprisonment as a possibility, without getting into the discussion of whether that's as effective or not, but if that was the perspective that was being suggested, that if one has the option of life imprisonment and that could effectively place someone out of the risk of killing anyone else, so then maybe we don't have the right to assume this role of executioner. And that was, I believe, the dominant rabbinic approach at that time. And the policy that the Israeli government has maintained, if I'm not mistaken, is that they don't have the death penalty for anything except for Nazi war criminals. So Adolf Eichmann, for that one event is outside of normal rules of history. But for general society, even in a society rampant with such concerns of terrorism and the like, for the most part, the Israeli government does not have the death penalty for normal crimes, possibly influenced by this discussion 50 years ago as to whether or not, religiously speaking, a Jewish government would have the right or would not have the right to take upon itself this role of executioner. So that would suggest a whole second setting in which we could talk about the execution of the death penalty. But one could argue that neither of these settings are really relevant to the American government. That if we look as citizens of America, so then the question is, maybe there's really a third model, and perhaps the most likely a third model. We find in the drushes in this week's Parsha, and a little bit in last week's Parsha, that there are mitzvos that affect all of humanity, the mitzvos of B'nai Noach. And when it comes to the mitzvos of B'nai Noach, so there are essentially six prohibitions, or six things that you're not allowed to do. And then there is one positive mitzvah, the positive mitzvah known as din. So that mitzvah means justice. What it means practically is a little bit of a debate. There was another machlokus between the Rambam and the Ramban about this. It comes up in Parshas Vayishlach. You don't often find the Rambam in Mishneh Torah dealing with parshanas, dealing with interpreting stories in Chumash. In this case, you do in Parshas Vayishlach. So we know there is the episode where Dina is attacked by Shechem, and Shimon and Levi, they go and they essentially execute the whole city of Shechem in the aftermath. So what exactly is the understanding there? So the Rambam writes in Mishneh Torah that this is a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Din, that the mitzvah of Din, in his understanding, means that society has to uphold the other six mitzvahs, and that Shechem, the individual, had violated the Noahide prohibitions in what they did. And by harboring him, by not dealing with him, so the whole town was in violation of the mitzvah of din. And when it comes to the Shabbat mitzvah of Bnei Noach, and this is something we'll have to discuss, so the Gemara says that we don't have all the different punishments, we only have one. The Gemara says, Azarasan, Zohi Misasan, that there is the instruction itself, the prohibition itself carries with it the punishment of death, and therefore that's the standard punishment for all the Shabbat mitzvah of Bnei Noach. So the members of the city were in violation of this mitzvah of din, therefore they were all chayiv misa. So that's why Shimon and Levi had to kill them all. There's a whole then discussion, some of the Mefarshim on Chumash, and the Urachayim and others get involved in this discussion about why the men and not the women. There's a mitzvah only on the men, that's what it sounds like, that's what the Rambam writes, that the judge would have to be male. Why did they take their money? The money was a knas, and that's also part of the din. Is it kimle? But the rabbinate, a lot of interesting side discussions that all come from this point. And the Ramban disagreed. The Ramban, in his commentary to Chumash, doesn't usually take on the Rambam and Halacha, but they're both flipping around. The Rambam's discussing the story in Chumash. The Ramban takes him on in his commentary to Chumash. The Ramban doesn't think this is a correct interpretation of what's going on. He has a couple of different planes of disagreement. Says, first of all, he understands din a little bit differently. He understands din as civil law, that there should be a civil code of justice in society. And says a very big chiddush, he says it's the same as the Jewish code. You know, according to the Rambam, presumably, we have a halacha of gezel, so you have a halacha you can't steal. Nobody's allowed to steal from each other. So it sounds like it's up to society to figure out how the rules should be regulated, how ownership should be defined, how different civil laws should be codified. According to the Ramban, it's that they follow the whole laws of the Torah, they follow all of Choshen Mishpat, that's a universal code, which is an interesting chiddush. It's not the case that it's all so intuitive, they could have figured it out on its own. It's not so simple. So it's a big chiddush to say like that, but that's the way the Ramban understands. And he says also, it's hard to say that Shimon and Levi were doing the right thing. The Rambam's perspective seems to be that they were justified. So the Ramban says, but we see that Yaakov was angry at them. So first of all, if Yaakov should have been doing it himself, if they were right. And if you want to say that he was too old or he was afraid, so then he shouldn't have been angry at them. So the fact that he's angry at them shows that they weren't acting properly. So he takes issue with them from that perspective. And he says also, it's not true that they would be chayiv misa for failing to carry out din. He says, yes, it's true that there's a chayiv misa for the prohibitions. If one commits a prohibition, so then there is a punishment of death. But the same way we find in Jewish law, the law for Jews, that very often an act of transgression has a punishment, but failing to do something usually doesn't. So too, he says the same is true by Bnei Noach. Maybe there's a punishment for committing an offense, but for failing to do something, even if there was an obligation of justice that they weren't carrying out, so that doesn't carry the death penalty. So he argues with the Rambam on different levels, and the Ramah has a shuv about this, and the Chasam Sofer has a whole discussion how exactly to understand this mitzvah of din. Just quickly mention one interesting discussion that draws on both opinions. There was a tshuva of Nassim Gestetner, who's a great posek in Bnei Brak, was asked, I don't know, it was probably about 20 years ago or so, about a woman who was in a fight with her husband about marital property, about who has the rights to money that she had. The money that she was getting, she was being paid reparations from the German government. She was a Holocaust survivor, and she was therefore receiving checks from the German government, and there's a whole debate about whether that's her personal money, whether the husband has rights to that money also. So without getting into technicalities of that discussion, so he notes, okay, so how do we understand this money? So here the government, she was basically injured, basically Dmei Chaval, the Torah says if you hurt somebody, so you have to pay. So maybe that's the category here. This is Dmei Chavala, we read about in Parshas Mishpatim. And we know from Ramban and Chumash, if you take that view, that the mitzvahs of civil law apply to all of society. Okay, so the German government is paying her Dmei Chavala. So then maybe that's the way to understand it. But then he goes on to say that maybe it's not the case, because maybe Dmei Chavala, even if it applies to all of society, but it applies to the one who did it. But the German government is not the Nazi government. The Nazi government has been deposed, replaced by a different government, so they're not the ones who committed this chavala. So maybe they're not obligated to pay, so then maybe the money is a gift. Maybe this is not categorized under existing Torah law. But then he says, no, that's why you have the Rambam. So the Rambam tells you that society is obligated, mitzvah din, to enforce everything else. So therefore, the German government is chayev, not as the perpetrators, the chayev is the government. The chayev is the system of din to take care of this. So therefore, it is money that's coming to her al-pidin. And perhaps that's the perspective to take. So without getting into the ins and outs of the marital property issues, it's just interesting how that draws on both halves of that equation. So essentially, we see here, this would really seem to be the more appropriate model for American society. Right? So we have a system where there is clearly a death penalty, and maybe it's not that we don't have justification, maybe we have too much justification. So now here, the Torah, the way the Gemara is understanding it, is asarasan zohi misasan, so there's a chiyuv misa for everything. So maybe we should be advocating the death penalty, maybe we should be advocating it much more, we should be advocating it for the thieves and for everybody else. That's not a position that you see anybody taking. So how do we look at it from that perspective? So that's really a tough question. So do we assume that there is an obligation of misa essentially much more broadly than we find in the Sanhedrin, not once every 70 years and not with all these rules? There are some rules, but the Rambam discusses what some of the rules are, the rules of the system, but they're far less restrictive. They're more, they are more intuitive. You know, one witness and different standards of evidence may not require the same standard of intent. Some of the Achronim point out the Tshuva Machane Chaim, who points out that this would seem to include an obligation of education, because everyone would have to know what the rules are in order to have such punishment, so that would have to be understood as also as part of the, that certainly have to be a basic level of fairness. It wouldn't have to rise to the same level of the Sanhedrin as far as all these requirements that are more ritually based, but there would certainly be a basic requirement of fairness. So is there any latitude within that setting not to have the death penalty? So that's an important question. So there are some suggestions. The Chalkes Yoav has a suggestion. Chalkes Yoav is a student of the Avnei Nezer, wrote the Shalos and Shuvis called Chalkes Yoav, and he has a section of questions in the back where he talks about this called Kavid Kashesa, all part of his Shuvis Chalkes Yoav, where he wants to suggest a little bit of an answer. It doesn't answer everything. And he says that maybe there is a chiyuv misa across the board for averos ben adam l'makom, for sins against God. So then, yes, there is a death penalty on the books always. But for sins against men, there's theoretically a death penalty. But if the society decides to have other punishments instead, they decide to send people to jail instead, so then there's a mechila involved. Then society as a whole is waiving their rights to execute, to protect their rights, and they're choosing a different level of punishment, and they have the right to do that. So that might help somewhat, but it doesn't fully allow for another system of justice. So it could be that you could take a different approach as well. You know, it's interesting, it's a little background to this approach. A number of years ago, it's when Pataki was first elected. So this would go back, I guess, maybe it could go back 15 years, something like that. So I was looking in the store. I saw an issue of New York Magazine, which had a very scientific study, clearly. It had a cover story. It said, the 100 smartest New Yorkers. But clearly, this is a very objective scientific study of who the 100 smartest New Yorkers were. And there were two people who were associated at the time with Yeshiva University on this list, 2% of the smartest New Yorkers. So one of the smartest New Yorkers was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. So the two problems with this. One problem is that he wasn't a New Yorker. He lived in Chicago and used to commute here. But the other problem is the picture that they had was a picture of the Rav, of Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. But other than that, Rav Aaron was on the list. So the format of this article was that they had, for every person, we couldn't have a whole article of 100 people in one magazine. So for every person on the list, they would have the name, a picture of their brother, and then a quote showing how smart they were. Basically, you know, you could tell from the quote how smart they were. So what was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's quote in this article? So Pataki had just been elected, and if you remember, he ran on a pro-death penalty platform. That Mario Cuomo had abolished the death penalty, and he ran on a platform of bringing it back. So Rav Aaron said to him, he addressed him through this article, or if he spoke to him directly, but he said that you should know, Governor Pataki, that the Talmud says that a Sanhedrin that would kill once in 70 years was a bloody Sanhedrin. You should make sure that New York State shouldn't be a bloody state. It shouldn't be a state that's too eager to impose a death penalty. And that was the reflection of the Talmud. So one could ask on this, well, hold on a second. We just spent all this time saying that we're not sure that that's really the best model, right? That we don't know necessarily that the rules that apply to the Sanhedrin should apply to New York State. It's not necessarily the case. New York State has its own category. Mitzvah did. We don't necessarily know that it would fit the same rules. So how could we understand Ryan Soloveitchik making this comment? So the answer is, it's Rav Aaron L'Shitaso. Rav Aaron printed an article in the Beis Yitzchak, in the YU Journal. And you have to read that in order to understand this, that Rav Aaron in New York Magazine is L'Shitaso with his article in Beis Yitzchak. And in the Beis Yitzchak, he explains that what's this idea that we say that Azaras and Zohim Yisrasim, that there's a Chi of Misa for everything. What does that mean? It says that the function of the Din, of the Beis HaMishpat, whatever you want to call it, of a court, in a secular society, in the Torah's vision, so we don't have all the different functions that we spoke about before. It's not about giving a kapara for anybody. It's not about achieving atonement. It's also probably not even about moral value, to say. It's about protecting society, that we don't want society to kill each other. That's what the Mishnah says. You have to pray for the government so people shouldn't eat each other alive. So we want that society should be safe and that standards of justice should be upheld. So what does it mean when we say Asarasa and Zohim Yisasa? So it says Rabbanan Soloveitchik. What it means is that the judge has to do what he needs to do in order to keep society safe. So he has discretion to impose whatever punishment he needs to in order to achieve that goal. And that discretion goes up to and including Misa, that if a judge were to decide that he wants to execute somebody, so the Torah is not going to say he's a murderer, he's not going to say he has no right to do that. It's not a violation of one of the Sheva Mitzvahs of murder, so that's not a violation. We know we have that value. We have that value in Parshas Noach, we have that value in the books. And in theory, the judge could decide to do that. That discretion exists. But it doesn't mean that that's the only way to do it in his understanding. It means that's the upper limit of his discretion. So he also has the right to say that we live in a society that could protect itself with lesser means, in theory, if that's the case. So then I could choose as a judge to do that. And that's also within that discretion. So if that's the case, then all the discussion comes back. So then everything that you want to look at from the Sanhedrin could become relevant. That even though the Sanhedrin is not the model, even though we're talking about a different system, we're talking about Din, but we have the right to say, well, we're trying to figure out a Jewish attitude. What is the Jewish attitude towards human life? What is the Jewish attitude towards punishing by taking life? What do we see from the way the Sanhedrin behaves? What do we see from the Mishpat HaMelech? What do we see from all the different settings? And to take all of that into the discretion that the judge was going to use, so that does become a reasonable perspective, even though it's from a different system. So that would explain what Rav Aaron was saying in New York Magazine. He's saying that we see from the Sanhedrin that the Sanhedrin was very hesitant to execute somebody. And that tells us something about the attitude, and the New York government, New York State government should also understand that attitude when they employ their discretion in how it's carried out. And it's interesting, without all of this explanation, you do see that that's the attitude that Rav Moshe Feinstein had. Rav Moshe Feinstein doesn't explain it like this, but this is here on the Mar Makomos. So Rav Moshe Feinstein was also addressing Governor of New York. It's not explicit in the tshuva, but he was addressing Governor Hugh Carey, who had been interested in the Jewish attitude towards the death penalty. And Rav Moshe wrote him a tshuva. And you see, really, that that's apparently what underlines his thinking on the matter. That first he goes through all of the restrictions that are present on the Sanhedrin. So he didn't seem to think it was irrelevant. He didn't tell the governor of New York, you don't have to worry about any of this. He did give him the background of what the Sanhedrin put into place in order to make sure it was only carried out appropriately. But then at the same time, so he flips things around. In the end, the last three lines, you can take a look here. I won't go through it now because we're almost out of time. But you see, he goes through here that, but if society is very much at risk and people are killing each other wantonly and there's a tremendous crime, You know, New York used to be different in the sense, and there's murder all over the place, so then maybe it's necessary for society to step up and to be harsh about this and to impose a death penalty, a different type of attitude than Rabbi Soloveitchik took, who took a more liberal perspective. But the lumdus seems to be the same. The Rav Moshe seems to be working from a perspective that, yes, New York has its own set of rules. We can talk about the Sanhedrin as far as understanding some of the philosophical underpinnings. And at the same time, the government has to make a decision based on what's necessary for society, what's required to protect society. And that seems to be what's underlying the tshuva that he wrote to a previous governor of New York. So if that's the case, then it leaves room for much discussion about some of the ins and outs. It doesn't leave us room because we're out of time, but there are a lot of other elements one could talk about. Just to throw out one, the question of tshuva, which also comes up in the secular system, especially because it could take 20 years to execute somebody. Somebody repents genuinely, so how do we deal with that? So there in the context of the Sanhedrin, so we don't find that tshuva works. We find that tshuva was assumed and yet executed anyway. So what does that mean about this? There's a whole discussion as to why that is. Is that because it can't be verified, or is that because of our moral system, the Joseph Engel, no to be who had a tshuva about it? So to what extent we parallel any of these discussions, all this goes back into this point. So just to quickly, I know some people need to leave, should feel free to leave, just to quickly review what we spoke about. So we spoke about the question of whether or not we can use the Sanhedrin model of saying the hesitancy to execute should be applied to American society. We mentioned that really there are different models to look at. On the one hand, there is the model of Sanhedrin. We find the machlokas among the Rishonim, how to count the mitzvah of the Sanhedrin to execute. The Ramban counting one mitzvah, Bi'artar Mekabecha, presumably to protect society. The Rambam counting four mitzvahs, Askulas Reiv, Harag and Chenek, presumably to help the offender get a kapara, and the Bahag counting many separate mitzvahs apparently to uphold the law. And then we saw that the Sanhedrin itself did have tremendous restrictions. You need to have two kosher witnesses, you need to have Hasra. Hasra had to be done before the crime, had to be done with his acceptance after Atzma Misa. We discussed how that could reflect the whole philosophical debate about society having the right to execute. The person has to accept the right of the Sanhedrin. And then the idea of Tochidei Dibor, what does that represent? The Rav's explanation about how it has to be so defiant that he's willing to commit a crime even after he still has it in his consciousness about what he's doing wrong, not just that he might forget about it in the broader sense. And then the question of the Sanhedrin itself, playing the role of defense attorneys and how they have striking halachas such as Ein Ed Nai Sadayin, and that you can't have a unanimous Sanhedrin, and all of that does result in a great hesitancy to execute anybody. So then what about protecting society? So we discussed the Mishpat HaMelech, how the Ran discusses in his drushes that both the king and the Sanhedrin have the right to act outside of the law. The whole debate in the Rishonim, whether it's only when they were acting for all of society, or acting for other Dina Fashas, or even later. And discussion of how that applies to the modern Israeli government, how the attitude seems to be that the capital punishment should not be utilized in the modern Israeli government, and the question of the mitzvah of din, the machlokas between the Rambam, who says it's a mitzvah to set up courts to enforce the other six, and the Ramban, who understands it as a code of civil law. And we saw the tshuva of Nachum Shtetner, who applies both to understanding reparations from the German government, both as a function of Dmei Chavala through civil law, and the German government enforcing it through the Rambam's code of din. And how all of that seems to be a more appropriate model for the American government, the obligation of din carrying with it Asarasa is doing misasa and carrying the automatic death penalty for everything. So we discussed some ways to see it a little bit less absolutely. The Chelkes Yol's approach that if the society has other punishments, then that's a mechila. And Ravina Soloveitchik's approach, consistent with his advice to Governor Pataki not to utilize the death penalty too much, that he understood it as discretionary, that the courts can do whatever needs to protect society, discretion up to and including the execution, but less also. And that seems to also be the perspective that Rav Moshe Feinstein reflects in his tshuva to a previous governor, to Hugh Carey. Right. Okay. Shkaf.
He started to mention tshuva.
But also, there's a lot of here next Sunday. No registration required. We'll vote together next Sunday.
And in addition, I mean, this was one of these oral cases where the detective, where they brought evidence that the defense minister was a lead master.